Welcome to Pop and Lock. I'm Landry Ayers.
And I'm Natalie Dowzicki.
Make sure you've got your shoulder pads in and your pager charged, because we are cracking open the cases of unexplained phenomena that are the X-Files. Joining us to discover if the truth is out there are historian and former assistant editor for intellectual history here at libertarianism.org, Anthony Comegna.
Hello.
And books editor at Reason and author of The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory, Jesse Walker.
Howdy.
So everyone, I thought it'd be good to start with, what makes you love The X-Files? Why is it just quintessential 1990s TV?
Oh man, I'll start with this one. There's this great literary scholar, Paul Cantor, who's sort of in the libertarian world. And he has this argument that I just love, that the X-Files and The Simpsons are the two greatest cultural products of that whole era in a generation's worth of time, and that they completely reflect the times in which they were made and the ideas floating around the world. And I personally, now that I've thought quite a bit about it in preparation for the show, I don't think any single thing has been more influential in making me who I am now, the kind of academic I try to be and the kind of libertarian I think I am, and just sort of my general approach to life has so much been shaped by this incredible show. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, it's interesting that The Simpsons and The X-Files actually aired on the same night on Fox for a while in the 90s. And between them, they had King of the Hill, which had that kind of anti-authoritarian cartoon flavor of The Simpsons, but a bit more of a sort of populist libertarian angle. And also on that night, right before The Simpsons, a crappy show, but it sort of fit in too, was America's Funniest Home Videos. Sort of like the awful corporate TV precursor to YouTube and so on. So you can sort of see like all the spirits in advance of social media era anti-authoritarianism in the Fox lineup of the mid-1990s. And I don't know quite what to make of that, but it I occasionally just find myself thinking about it at random while driving or showering or something.
Well, I think that's something that deserves a bit more elaboration, because this is part of that Paul Cantor argument that I mentioned. He points out that Fox was on this quest to become to break into the field of the major networks. There was only NBC, CBS, and ABC for like forever. And Fox was doing everything they could to avoid the kind of regulations that came along with being an official network, and yet run original programming and break into that network space. And they broke all the rules. They threw everything at the wall and saw what stuck. One of those rules was no sci-fi in primetime. Ever since Star Trek went down back in the 60s, there was no sci-fi in any primetime slot, and no animation in primetime. And they said, screw it, we're going to do it. We got these great, great shows. And it really made Fox the, titanic organization we know now.
Do you know why that rule came to be? Because sci-fi is like obviously a huge genre. I'm just wondering why, from like a business perspective, why no sci-fi was in primetime.
I think it was just that people thought it was hokey and weird, and you know, it was not fit for massive consumption. But what they did by giving it a shot, as with so many of their other shows, you know, Fox had this thing where they would start a show and cancel it right away, start a show, cancel it. And, you know, they would cut shows before their pilot season even ended. And they were just trying whatever they had in the pocket to see what worked. And they knew that if they tried a whole bunch, they would get some really, really big hits. So they just decided, you know what? We think there is a mass market out there for a really, really good sci-fi program. And it stuck.
So I think there were some primetime science fiction shows. They weren't necessarily seen as genre shows. I'm trying to remember what time the $6 Million Man was on, or Quantum Leap. But these were kind of... these weren't sort of processed as genre shows, you know, even though they obviously had science fiction elements. And I mean, one thing about TV in that kind of tightly regulated three network ad driven era was that, you know, there was not, since there wasn't as much room for experimentation, there was a whole lot of imitation, and it was a lot, and it was the sort of environment where it was a lot easier to just fall into path dependence and to assume that because something didn't work, it wouldn't work again. And just to do, you know, the umpteenth attempt to remake Friends with a slightly different cast. And that's the sort of thing that we've really, I mean, cable started breaking out of that. And then the addition of other networks, you know, helped as well. And of course, now we live in the streaming era and the rules have changed completely. But, you know, the vast wasteland thing was real. And it's just that, although I think the particulars of the complaint about the vast wasteland were wrong. I mean, it was sort of a snobbish complaint from the FCC commissioner about all this kind of lowbrow material. The idea that networks were afraid to experiment and to do something different was true, but the main reason for that was because of institutions like the FCC and the limits they put on competition and innovation and creating something different and just creating another space for things, which is the irony of that speech, since, of course, you know, it was an FCC commissioner who wanted even tighter regulations. That being, you know, the impetus behind it. Do you remember, Anthony, the first time you saw The X-Files?
Absolutely. I love this story, too, because it's the first TV show I remember clearly watching. It made that big an impression on me. I must have been about 5 years old. I think it was during the first season. It was in November. I think we were headed to my step-grandparents' house in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Probably for early Thanksgiving. And we got caught in the mountains in a really terrible snowstorm, and we had to pull over to a motel for the night and stay there. And my family, we were all, there were four of us. We like the heat was broken in this room. And so we were all huddled on the one bed under the covers together. And we turned on the TV, and it was the episode is called Ice. It's in the first season. It takes place in Antarctica.
Oh, one of my favorite episodes. Everything, it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically what's the movie that it's kind of a ripoff of? The Thing. Yeah, it's just isolation and coldness imagery everywhere. It fit the context perfectly, and we're all like huddled there in the dark and the cold, watching this. And right as somebody, you know, is about to be murdered by the body snatching parasite alien, the lights went out in our room. And the TV went off, and we just all screamed. And, you know, it just stuck with me forever. I was absolutely in love by how they made this show and the kinds of terrifying stories that they would come up with. It was just fantastic.
That sounds like a cold open to an X-Files episode. Like having to pull over in a storm in the middle of, you know, on your way to Altoona and going to a roadside motel and the lights going out. Just like I hear the music swelling as you tell it.
It was a perfect moment.
So I do not remember what the first episode I saw was, but what I do remember, I had... In 1993, I was a couple years out of college. I'd stuck around Ann Arbor for about a year. We was working at a bookstore, and then I got a job in the Pacific Northwest, and I had moved out to this small town. I didn't have cable. It wasn't really worth it because the local cable system just meant better reception. They didn't have any choices. I didn't have the internet because I had left that behind my university account, and I wouldn't rejoin for a few years. This is like a level of sort of media barrenness that is unimaginable to people today. I stayed in touch with, you know, my old friends in Michigan, and, you know, who, I mean, among other things, we had gotten together every week to watch Twin Peaks, which I think we're going to get into later as kind of a precursor to The X-Files. Certainly an example of that kind of new readiness to experiment in the 1990s. And I remember one of them just telling me, "Have you seen this show, The X-Files?" And I said, "No, I haven't heard of it." And he says, "Oh well, it's." I said, "What is it?" He says, "Well, you know, it's this show. I guess the idea is there are these files of the unexplained things that the FBI, blah blah blah." And I kind of got this vague sense that it was like some sort of Leonard Nimoy In Search Of type show where they, you know, have like some sort of fake to do about you know, something, you know, a Loch Ness monster or whatever. So I came out of this bad explanation with the sense that I had no interest in this show whatsoever. And I stumbled onto it. I remember it was one night where they were trying to bring in more viewers by showing a bunch of episodes in a row. And I just watched that whole evening and realized that, no, this was something very different. In retrospect, being in a tiny apartment in the rural Northwest is kind of the ideal place to start watching The X-Files. I remained a fan I kind of tuned out for the last few seasons, but watched pretty consistently through 1998 or 9 or so.
Jesse, you bring up a point about the media landscape today and how that your type of disconnection and isolation from media would be shocking to a lot of people today. Do you think a show like The X-Files, is there an equivalent today that you think is sort of accomplishing similar things, whether in tone or in sort of popularity? And would a show like The X-Files, in its like purest, most appreciated sense, be appreciated today?
So it's difficult for me to answer that because my media consumption patterns have changed so much. I watch more shows just binge watching after they're over or three seasons in now than I do by paying attention week to week. There are like, you know, maybe three or so shows at any given time I will actually watch from week to week. And even then I might fall behind. So I'm just sort of not plugged in the way you could be when there was, you know, four commercial networks plus PBS. But I will say that part of that sort of change to the landscape we're talking about was this discovery that you could pursue a niche audience, that you could pursue a cult audience. I mean, that was sort of a big buzzword in the 90s. Not cult as in, you know, get in a circle in the woods and sacrifice somebody, but cult as in the devoted fans of a particular property. Obviously that was part of like the discovery of the science fiction audience in primetime was being able to do this. So, and that's actually one of the ways I think The X-Files is a precursor, even if people consume The X-Files differently than they might today consume Riverdale or, I'd say that because I actually watch it, but you know, whatever other sort of, or Mr. Robot, which I guess went off the air about a year ago, or something else that's kind of in the same lineage as X-Files.
It's also funny because right now, I feel like we see an explosion of these sci-fi shows. They're much more popular than they were back when The X-Files first started, but they all look very different. So even like if it's dystopia, so like something like The 100 is very popular and has a very like cult-like, again, not like Kool-Aid cult, but like very loyal audience. And I think partially it's due to X-Files that we have this offshoot of many different sci-fi genres. I'm going to out myself here. This is the first time I've ever seen an X-Files episode. It was last week. I still think it is popular today, as in getting to Landry's question, that it can still be consumed today and seen as like popular and interesting. I thought it was very entertaining. I really liked it. And I was skeptical going into watching it. But I think one of the biggest things that struck me was that it seemed so ahead of its time in terms of casting. I noticed right away that there's a strong female lead. Scully's a strong female lead, which was, from my understanding, not, especially in primetime, not something that occurred normally, unless it was like a soap opera show. Then there are obviously more females than those. But and then I read up on it later that the creator of the show actually did that intentionally, hoping that more shows would respond with more female characters or strong female leads. And I was even thinking, like, going back to The 100 has a strong female lead as well. So I'm wondering if X-Files kind of opened the door to a more robust sci-fi genre that we have today.
Yeah, I mean, its influence is considerable just because it was both so successful and, you know, so well written and had such good chemistry between the leads and, you know, all the things that make people still watch it today. Of course, it also had, I got to say, one sort of negative influence. And this is something which you don't necessarily get when you're watching it retroactively, but when you were watching it week to week, there was this kind of shift where at the beginning, the mythology episodes were something you looked forward to, like you were unlocking these sort of larger pieces of a bigger puzzle. And after a few years, at least for me, anytime there was a mythology episode, I would be like, oh God, it's going to be more of this stuff that doesn't add up. Just get back to the damn monster of the week. Give me a well-written show that is resolved in, story that is resolved in 50 minutes. Some shows are able to actually keep the momentum, have an overarching plot that they've thought out in advance or that they're able to, in an improvisatory way, turn into something that works. And they even sometimes get better as they go along. But there have been so many examples of places that just kind of wrote themselves into a corner the way the X-Files ultimately did. I mean, Lost is kind of the famous example, but, Lost, you know, there are other ones.
Dexter.
Yeah, so I think that was, the X-Files should have been more of a negative lesson, but I think, you know, like, don't do this. But a lot of people thought, well, I just won't make the mistakes the X-Files did. I'll do it this way. There's actually a moment in the final episode of the original run of the X-Files where Mulder is testifying before like a secret government tribunal or something like that. And at one point, the judge or whoever is in charge turns to him and says, "Is this going anywhere?" And I thought, oh, so many times I've said that to the screen while watching this show.
Yeah, so much of the show just became, they did have a really great balance, though, I thought, between those sort of story arc, series arc episodes and the Monster in the Box episodes. Because they did really draw you back in, like you said, for years and years until maybe you ended up getting tired of it in the long run. You know, everybody wanted to see another smoking man scene, right? And it even made it into that song, whose name I can't remember. I hope the smoking man's in this one. Like, people definitely wanted that. And, this might get us into talking about Twin Peaks a little bit, because as I understand I use my quarantine time on advice of Cato's own Caleb Brown to watch Twin Peaks. And as I understand it, David Lynch's intention going into that show was to always leave the murder of Laura Palmer unsolved, specifically because he hated how TV had become this, like, throwaway thing where you tune into a meaningless episode each week that goes nowhere except, you know, with somebody dying at the end and justice being served and whatever. And what he wanted to do is show how the murder of a single person like Laura Palmer could so deeply impact people's lives across this place of Twin Peaks. And he never wanted it to be solved. And in that way, she keeps moving on, affecting people and affecting the viewer. And essentially, the audience and the network muscled him out of that plan and made them wrap up the murder of Laura Palmer earlier in season two. And so David Lynch quit the show, and it just went downhill from there. It was terrible for most of that season, right up till the very end when he came back. I think I get the sense, at least, that the X-Files sort of tried to learn from that and decide, we're never going to really know whether the aliens exist or not, or whether Mulder is correct about all or any of his theories or not. We're going to keep this sense of doubt and mistrust going on and on and on and on throughout the course of the entire show. The main characters won't even know what they think anymore by the end of it. And I think you see that play out over and over. And it does, for me at least, it adds a lot of really good flavor to the dynamic, especially between Mulder and Scully and the questions involved about who to trust and what to do with certain types of authority.
Although I got to say, at some point when he was saying, maybe I don't believe in aliens anymore, I want to say, Well, remember on that Monster of the Week alien episode where you actually saw an alien? there was this failure to sort of like collect those as part of the clues as well that started to get on my nerves. But yeah, I mean, you're right about Twin Peaks. I don't remember if Lynch actually left the show or not. It's been so long, but
yeah, he did.
Yeah, I do remember
he quit
that.
In a rage.
Is that I had during the first season when it was super popular. I mean, I thought it was bizarre that the hype around it was sort of in that kind of who shot JR style, who killed Laura Palmer, mm-hmm. when to me, that was not what was interesting about this show. And certainly those, I mean, I would watch that as a communal thing with a group of people. And I don't remember any of us like afterwards trying to theorize about, I mean, maybe a little bit. I mean, it was more like these sort of weird moments of, you know, the FBI agent suddenly going off on a rant about Tibet and throwing stones. That was the sort of stuff we wanted to rewatch. We were interested in these characters. We were interested in the surrealism. We were interested in the humor. And, you know, if an episode had a lot of those moments, then, you know, our housemate might get home from work and we say, oh, we're going to watch this again, because we would always record it on VHS tapes. Again, this is like another media era. so, you know, and it was bizarre to me that I don't know how typical we were, but I felt like there was a disconnect between what a lot of the fans were getting out of the show and what a lot of the network hype machine thought we wanted to get out of the show. And what they were playing up in the advertisements. And of course, back then there were online discussions, but the web didn't even exist. I mean, we're talking about Usenet and its counterparts. And so you can actually go back and look at those, but I'm not so sure that it was influencing network, for better or for worse, network decisions the way online discussions can today.
This is kind of a good segue into the very first episode, and I saw that Jesse pointed this out in his notes too, is that in the opening credits, it says the following story is inspired by actual documented accounts. And I think this is, again, kind of at that surrealist point. I looked at that and I like had a very puzzling look. I was like, wait, isn't this show about like aliens and like conspiracy
That's
theories?
Right. That's right, like, Natalie.
And I was like, am I reading this correctly?
Well, that's the sort of thing that makes you think you're watching In Search Of, you know, I mean,
right.
And that's, I think that there was really that kind of a genre influence of those old sort of 70s shows on the X-Files. And also, of course, the other thing is that this is at the peak or one of the peaks of public interest in the idea of alien abductions. You had all these people who had said they'd had recovered memories of being abducted by aliens. This was a huge pop culture thing right then, and a lot of people believed this was actually going on. And I think part of what was going on there was kind of an effort to appeal to that audience. And maybe there's some half-assed way that it's half true, like it's documented that somebody claimed this happened to them under hypnosis, you know. But that's itself part of the political context of the pilot. I mean. The two most important things to me as far as like when the X-Files started is, first of all, it's in that moment, that historical moment after the Cold War and before the War on Terror. Mm-hmm. And this is like the one time in my life that the United States has not been sort of permanent in this sort of permanent mobilization against an enemy, an outside enemy. And that had a real interesting impact on the culture. And part of, and I think we might get into this later, one thing the X-Files does is to rewrite the history of the Cold War. But another thing it does, and this is, you know, related to that, is to start imagining enemies elsewhere, which really fits what a lot was happening. Certainly on the political right, you had this sort of people who in the past might have been suspicious of, you know, the Soviets were now casting, looking at something like Waco or Ruby Ridge and casting their eyes upward and being much more suspicious of government that they were cheering on, you know, rah, rah, just 5 or 10 years earlier. But also, you know, the alien abduction, I mean, the abduction story goes back, a different sort of abduction story goes back a long ways in American history. You have, captivity narratives in the earliest, some of the earliest literature of the colonial era, people talking about being captured by Indians and living among them and then coming out. This was not, I mean, there's actually an even earlier version of the genre in Europe with people being captured by pirates. And there's a passage I brought here from Richard Slotkin, who's a historian and literary scholar in a great book called Regeneration Through Violence, describing the archetypal captivity story. He says, a single individual, usually a woman, stands passively under the strokes of evil, awaiting rescue by the grace of God. In the Indian's devilish clutches, the captive had to meet and reject the temptation of Indian marriage and or the Indian's quote-unquote cannibal Eucharist. To partake of the Indian's love or his equivalent of bread and wine was to debase, to un-English, the very soul. There was this idea of you being captured by an alien force. And I should add that, you know, in a lot of the early conspiracy theories of colonial era, it's not just Indian conspiracy. They were believed to be actually being directed by Satan. And even in some cases to have been brought over from Europe by Satan when Christianity spread Europe and he wanted his own base elsewhere. And then to have to be violated their body in ways that I think we're familiar from later alien abduction accounts. And to be the threat of being turned into something that is not fully human yourself. And over the course of the X-Files, this idea of hybrids among us becomes like a big part of the scare there. So the sort of the underlying master plot. So you've got this old story that has come up in different guises that's now being sort of presented in this extraterrestrial context. And it's popping up at this time when you don't have a natural sort of enemy like Osama bin Laden or Leonid Brezhnev that you can point to, just a sort of more ethereal force in the skies that may or may not be aligned by forces within our own society. That's a really potent combination. And in some ways, one that has some kind of creepy underlying politics, but it can be a really potent story, a source for sort of paranoid storytelling. So, and then one other thing I'll throw in, but I've talked too long, is this is also the tail end of the Satanic Panic. And in the pilot episode, there is sort of a throwaway reference to like, well, maybe it's a satanic cult. No, I think it's this. But that also had that kind of idea of people under hypnosis having recovered memories of something terrible being done to them. And for a lot of people, I think aliens kind of took the place of what was believed to be either the devil itself or people who believed in the devil in this story. So, I mean, this is the context of 1993, when you have this pilot story, which is, you know, echoing Twin Peaks. You've got the FBI going to the rural Northwest to investigate a crime. But, you know, then ultimately winds up going in a very different direction.
Well, it's also interesting that you bring up this is kind of like the height of alien abduction kind of being like a real fear, or maybe not a real fear, but it's talked about more, because isn't this also the time period that like Independence Day and Mars Attacks, like those movies came out, which are like, yeah, I think that those were like the late 1990s, like 96 or 97, I think, which are like some of the most popular alien abduction movies still today. They just did a sequel to Independence Day, actually, not too long ago. But okay, I have to ask, do you think this show convinced anyone that aliens are real?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, definitely.
Okay.
And I'm not saying me, Landry. I know you're thinking it.
No, I was just waiting for it. I was waiting for someone to be like, and I am one of those people.
Yes.
No, my family actually used to make fun of me because I had a really, really big head and big ears as a kid. And they said I looked like an alien. So I was maybe predisposed against the whole idea in the first place because I'm a human, damn it.
By the way, this was also the big boom in pop culture of angel stories. I was working in the original actual Borders bookshop, if you remember that chain in Michigan before I left town. And there was suddenly like all these books about angels, people buying angel books, people buying angel tchotchkes. It became a big pop culture thing. And there was sort of the Christian version. There was sort of the New Age version. But it was, you know, palpably the benevolent counterpart to the alien narratives, especially the New Age versions of it, where you sort of get completely detached from sort of familiar theology, and it just becomes, you know, this benevolent force in the skies intervening in people's lives. So that's also part of the context. And it would be, I don't remember the X-Files doing an angel episode. Maybe I missed one, but that would have been an interesting genre crossover if they ever had.
Huh.
Well, there was certainly, I mean, there's huge elements of discussions of faith, especially like one thing we're not going to talk about much because it's not that good. But my father, who is a big X-Files fan, and the reason that I got into the show, we saw the movie that came out several years ago, I think it's I Want to Believe, which is a huge exploration of faith and angels. And I, going back and rewatching the show, that sort of theme is certainly prevalent throughout X-Files as well. And sort of the sort of comparison of you know, belief and blind faith, whether it's in aliens or in God or angels, is certainly palpable as well.
I think it's important to note, along with Jesse's last point there, that this is also the era when Eric Von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods was massively huge, and he was coming out with sequels to that now and then, and that whole field of sort of ancient pseudo-archaeology was booming, and people very clearly started relating angels and aliens as the same thing. And that was sort of no longer looked at as some kind of purely off the wall new agey thing, but it was now something that, you know, real religious people who adhere to the biblical dogma could actually get behind and not feel like they were, you know, renouncing their faith by believing in aliens.
Although there's also, I mean, I looked at some of this literature when I was writing the conspiracy book. There was a rich vein of Christian literature in which which was against the angel boom because they believed the angels that people believed they were contacting were demons in disguise. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff gets sort of switched. But you're right. I mean, Von Daniken, his big moment was in the 70s, early 80s, because I was a little kid. I remember that being something we talked about on the playground. But there was this next wave of it from people like Graham Hancock in the 90s, yeah. Which I think made it even more mainstream, at least in some circles. And that's part of the backdrop to this, too. I think you're right.
Coast to Coast AM also started up in this era and fuses these kinds of narratives together. And tries to make sense out of all of it and fit it into people's pre-existing worldviews. I love the dynamic of course, Scully is the skeptic and Mulder is the true believer, but Scully's a Catholic, at least for most of the show. And she, you know, professes this belief in God, and she wants to believe too, even though she well knows that she has no conclusive evidence one way or the other. But she can't, she still can't seem to relinquish that because it provides her some genuine comfort, something she feels like she can hold on to and count on. The more that she sees, you know, the world go to hell and everybody is a liar and everybody's distrustworthy or mistrustworthy. And, you know, she still finds value in simply believing in her faith, even though it is challenged over and over again.
I think this might be a good time to get into like the specific episodes that we watched and maybe dive into those a little bit more. I'll go right out there. Clive Bruckman was my favorite episode by far of the five that we watched. I actually watched the one we said we weren't going to watch too, but I think it was my favorite by far because it was one of the ones where I was hoping like this could actually happen, if that makes sense. Like I was like thought it from a like a cool angle that I'm like, oh, this if this was if this, any of them were to be real, it would be best if this one was real. And I was kind of wondering what you guys thought of the Clyde Bruckman episode. Do you think would it be cool to know how people die? Would you not want that superpower? Let's call it a superpower.
I definitely would not want that superpower.
No.
Okay, me neither.
First of all, let's just say Peter Boyle is fantastic in this episode.
Absolutely.
I always enjoy Peter Boyle, but this is one of my favorite performances he ever did. And also just like one of the Easter egg here, eggs here, is that there was a real person named Clive Bruckman who was a Hollywood director in this in the silent era. He worked with Buster Keaton and others, and he ultimately committed suicide. So that's part of like the I mean, this is one of the episodes that Darren Morgan wrote. He's the best writer who ever came to the show, in my view. And he regularly undermined all the sort of basic ideas of the show. This is not my personal favorite of these five, I think it's definitely one of the best episodes they ever did. And you can see that sort of the way it mocks Mulder in particular, the way that it sort of mocks the, it gets more into this with the other Morgan episode we're talking about, but kind of mocks the idea of, you know, whether, you know, of the truth and whether you actually want to know the truth. And then there's this underlying sort of discussion of free will versus determinism, which is there in a smart way, but never in a heavy-handed way. And that, you know, it's just very well written.
Yeah.
Also about our ability to see patterns in coincidence, which is a big part of what, you know, I mean, again, sort of poking fun at the very raison d'etre for the X-Files, which is finding conspiracies everywhere.
On the subject of free will, we had a long discussion about Westworld a few months ago, and obviously that show is very, very heavy-handed on us telling you that it's about free will. I can't think of a show that's more heavy-handed on it. But I think on a whole, from the episodes that we watched, X-Files is much more subtle, which makes it a bit less like in your face and a little more believable, if that makes sense. So like, for instance, like we talked about earlier, they're not coming out and saying whether or not aliens do or do not exist. They're kind of like leading the audience on. And I kind of find that much more entertaining than like hand holding us and like telling this is how it happens, then this is how it ends, that kind of stuff. And I really appreciated that from the show that I've seen so far. And I'm gonna keep watching too. Yes. Now that I've gotten
yes.
hooked onto Good. The show. But I did think it was really interesting because I am a huge Westworld fan, and like I did pick up on the elements of free will throughout the Clive Bruckman episode, but I thought it was done in a more flawlessly than they talk about free will in Westworld.
See, I think my favorite episode is probably the least subtle of the ones that we watched, Postmodern Prometheus. And it's just, you know, it's right out there, obviously a Frankenstein remake, and they do just throw the message right at you. Mulder has this little soliloquy he gives about, look what you've all become. And, you know, but it's just, it's great. It's such a great episode. It's quirky, goofy, artsy, funny. And I love it when a really like dark and serious sci-fi show can break out of that so well and write a comedy episode or an artsy episode. And I think this is kind of both. And, you know, like to me, the only other show that does it maybe as well as The X-Files is Stargate, the original Stargate series. And I think that was in part, at least, because nobody took that show seriously. Like it's just one of these pew pew laser battle type shows with lots of big explosions in space. And so, you know, when they wrote a comedy episode, it was just great. And, you know, I think that people may not have even really thought to do that if not for a show like The X-Files breaking out of it at least, you know, twice a season and doing such a great job at it. It's not cheesy and dumb like when Star Trek does it. It's still so good. Absolutely top notch.
So, you know, what show is like, to my mind, the extension of the X-Files comedy episodes was Gravity Falls. If any of you guys watched that cartoon.
Yeah, I've seen some of it. It certainly does. It leans on that, certainly.
Yeah. So can I make 2 points about Postmodern Prometheus? Because this is one of my favorite episodes.
Absolutely.
It's certainly my favorite one that Darren Morgan didn't write. But this is the one that happens when the show is confident enough in itself that it's willing to end an episode by having Mulder and Scully take Frankenstein's monster to a Cher concert. And that's the kind of thing you do. I mean, either you're jumping the shark or you are reaching new levels of the sublime. And in this case, I mean, that final scene is one of the most I mean, whatever else you think about the rest of the episode, which I enjoy, they have Jay Peterman as Frankenstein.
Yes,
it's, but I mean, that is one of the most joyful scenes I've ever seen on television. Certainly the most joyful scene in this show. But the wild thing about it is that, I mean, it's preceded, of course, by Mulder saying, this is not how it should end. I want to see the writer. I want a new ending. And I think that scene is the alternate ending for the series as a whole. The central horror of the X-Files is this idea of alien invaders abducting people and violating their bodies and producing hybrids. And this is a story about this alien-seeming creature invading people's homes, violating their bodies in ways that are actually really kind of creepy to think about, and producing hybrids. And then that final scene reimagines the whole idea as a utopia. They all come together. Everybody is happy. The monster is at, you know, the peak of happiness, and Mulder and Scully are dancing together. And it's like everything you would want from what if everyone, all this could get along, in this story that, you know, in itself is just really kind of effective. And it's been Chris Carter, who created the series and wrote the mythology episodes and so on. He wrote this episode, and I think he was not just setting out to write a Frankenstein pastiche, not just setting out to do his version of a Darren Morgan episode, not just saying, you know, how can I, you know, do an homage to the Universal movies and have a soundtrack that makes it feel like Tim Burton and so on. It's like, I think he was saying, you know, this is a completely alternate take or reimagining of the X-Files. And that's part of what makes it such a resonant episode, even if some of that works on a more... and that is a way that I think it's being subtle, even if he kind of holds your hand and shouts in your face and at other moments.
Yeah, it's certainly, I had seen a lot of the X-Files before. Not getting into the later seasons, or I've seen, you know, bits and pieces here and there. But for some reason, I had never seen Postmodern Prometheus, at least not to my recollection. It really stuck out to me because it didn't feel like an X-Files episode, but not in the way that other episodes that kind of are supposed to be sort of lampooning different things necessarily do. Those still feel they have that sort of X-Files banter or like odd pacing, but it still feels like in within the same vein. Whereas Postmodern Prometheus really did, the ending was a big shift for me. Like I could justify it watching the first 90% of it, but when they get to the nightclub where I was really hoping that they actually had gotten Cher for the episode, and then when they kept avoiding her face, I was like, yeah, that would have been the perfect, you know, cherry on top to actually get Cher for it. But it was so odd to me, even for an X-Files episode, and I wasn't sure what to think of it. And like something that Jesse had mentioned, the hybridization violation of the people of the town to create these human animal hybrids, it made me uncomfortable. But then when they were the juxtaposition of the animals versus the humans in the town at first, because it's this sort of mob moment where they're pointing at them saying, look what you've become. I was like, oh, they're trying to compare the people, you know, we're no better than the animals or something like that. And then I realized what they were trying to insinuate. And I was like, oh, this is even worse. And then they all get together at the end and they go see Cher and everyone's like, you know what? It's cool. I couldn't square it. So it certainly... I will never forget it, and I didn't hate it, but I was not, it didn't give me what I wanted out of an X-Files episode. But then I also, as soon as it ended and the book cover closes and you see Chris Carter's name on the back, you are reminded that the entire thing is framed as a comic book. It's a la The Great Mutado, that book. And that at the very end is a reminder of how you have to conceive of the episode. And I think taking that sort of comic book-esque framing justifies it and makes it all the more palatable. in a way that if you just remove those two frames from the very beginning and very end with the comic book covers and fade ins, I wouldn't have appreciated it as much. But I think that kind of justified it for me.
Shout out to the Jerry Springer show here, too, because a lot of those violations, the people in the town didn't seem to mind it too much because they got what they really wanted, which was some excitement, some attention, some story to tell. And that's what really mattered to them.
And I think this leads into another sort of episode that we watched. And we picked a handful for Natalie to watch because she had not experienced the show before. And we picked quite the grab bag for her.
Some of these are not very representative, Natalie.
Yes. Yeah. But I think you still appreciated them. And I think eventually you'll be able to go back and appreciate some of that mythology arc that Jesse was talking about. So we watched the pilot. We watched Clyde Bruckman, which is one of my personal favorites because Peter Boyle was so great in it. We watched Postmodern Prometheus. And another one that kind of bucks the trend of X-Files episodes, but to me is a little bit more true to the tone, is the next one and another one of my favorites, Jose Chung's From Outer Space. Another Darren Morgan episode, sort of a Rashomon-style rehashing of events from a collection of unreliable narrators that I... Another masterful guest performance by Charles Nelson Reilly, who is an incredible character, but also more cameos from people like Jesse Ventura and Alex Trebek.
Let's be respectful here. It's the body, okay? Governor Jesse the Body Ventura.
Of course. Right. Of course.
Please get the name right.
My apologies, Governor. This was
before he was a governor and before he was a famous conspiracy theorist. And I like to imagine this was the beginning.
This is what did it, yeah. What made you both interested in discussing this story? Because I believe you both suggested it, if not at least one of you.
I just think it's another very fun episode. And I love the fun episodes because they're done so well. Almost universally. I really can't think of a fun episode of The X-Files that just is not fantastic. I'm sure they're out there, especially in the Agent Doggett seasons, but it's just so great. And yeah, you gotta love Jesse the Body popping in there. It's the real Men in Black.
I will say on the topic of fun episodes, the Forrest Gump pastiche did not quite work for me. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go on. Go on, Anthony. I'm sorry. I stepped on
you. Oh, no, that was it. I just love how fun it is. And yeah, the cameos are great.
Yeah.
And unreliable narrator stories are so interesting. So
yeah, this is my favorite episode of the show. It's one of my favorite episodes of any shows. It's back to that sort of original setup of, the pilot, an alien abduction in the Pacific Northwest, or seems to be an alien abduction. But this is the one that really, I think, turns the whole, in a different way than Postmodern Prometheus, turns the show on its head. Because the big quest in The X-Files is to determine the truth. And this is a episode that, among other things, is about the impossibility of ever quite getting to the truth. And about just the sort of misperceptions and miscommunications, that make up human communication, or just human society. At very least, a truth that can be captured by a single master narrative. It's even more postmodern than the episode with postmodern in the title. And it's also, if the big flaw in the show as a whole was the fact that it tried to sum things up in a master narrative and failed to, this is the one that, Philip K. Dick had a great essay called How to Build a Universe That Doesn't Fall Apart 2 days later, or 2 hours, or whatever it was. And he basically says in there, honestly, I I get a great pleasure in building universes that do fall apart 2 days later, which if you read Philip K. Dick makes sense. Well, this is an episode by someone who loves just pulling the strands pulling the yarn on the sweater and having it all fall apart. I'm completely mixing metaphors there. I mean, and it's got all these embedded in jokes. I mean, you know, Jose Chung is a sort of mashup of John Keel with Richard Condon, you know, people are whose names are, you know, mashups of like UFO believers and UFO skeptics. Always has its tongue in its cheek. And it really kind of gets down to the fact that, you know, alien abductions aren't real. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that is my view on the subject. But belief in alien abductions is real. And this is a story that talks about the nature of belief and memory and self-doubt and self-deception. And the fact that on the one hand, even if you can't quite bring yourself to believe, a lot of believers can't really believe themselves fully believe in this. The flip side is a lot of skeptics still have nagging moments of doubt about stuff they can't explain. So like this episode, a lot of stuff can be ultimately explained if you think about it. But there are a couple things that are just flatly contradictory. I mean, the big one being when you have the two versions of Mulder going into the coffee shop. In one, he talks with the person who gives him the whole, and in the other, he just sort of comes in and he's like, he's almost doing an Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks.
What I was thinking. Impression. The most Twin Peaks.
Yeah. And just sort of does that sort of, and there's that, one of my favorite jokes in it is when, because this is not just the one where we find out the men in black are Jesse Ventura and Alex Trebek. This is the one where someone else meets Mulder and Scully and thinks they're the men in black. And actually calls, what was it that he calls Scully? Like the woman man in black, the female man in black?
Yeah.
She was trying to pull off an impression of a red-haired woman and not doing it very well. Yeah. I think how he puts
a little
it.
Too red, yeah. And some of the, I mean, like the alien, the parody of the alien autopsy dissection video, which was, those of you who weren't around in the 90s, this was a big TV event. What was supposed to be an on-camera, dissection of an extraterrestrial, which is, you know, up there with, you know, going into Al Capone's vault in terms of, you know, TV belly flops. It's a wonderful episode. And the only problem, as with a postmodern Prometheus, the only problem with just setting someone down and saying, watch this, is that you appreciate it much more if you have sat through a couple seasons of this show and see all the ways that it's, parodying and answering and engaging with what the show usually does.
Plus, there's the cigarette-smoking alien, right, who's freaking out.
Right.
And that's just The episode that is most like this in my mind that is also absolutely fantastic is in the latest season called The Lost Art of Forehead Sweat, which is a terribly unreliable narrator telling an absolutely ridiculous comic bookified story of his having actually been Mulder's old partner, Mulder and Scully's partner. And then it replays all these scenes from the old show where he's just sort of popped in the background and says some clever quip and they cut to the next scene. And it's just great. They do this so well.
The final episode that we watched is, I think, one of the more traditional style episodes. It leans towards, but doesn't get directly involved in ideas of the mythology arc and the sort of government conspiracy and involvement with things, though not necessarily with aliens, but leans less on aliens and more on the government conspiracy theme, is the Pine Bluff variant, in which Mulder is undercover, trying to infiltrate a militia-like group that is spreading some sort of bioweapon in different places, and not even Scully knows what's going on until a certain point in this episode. And I was curious, Jesse, you suggested this one because of its comparison with another episode from season four called Unrequited, because they both deal with like militia-like groups or something like that. Would you care to explain why you think these two are interesting?
Yeah, well, this is another part of like sort of locating the original X-Files in the time period that it was produced. I mean, the militia movement emerged in the 1990s. And I talked earlier about sort of it, the context of Waco and Ruby Ridge, not having the Cold War around and not having the War on Terror yet. On the one hand, the militias held a lot of conspiracy theories, including some that overlap with the conspiracy theories in the X-Files. On the other hand, there were a lot of conspiracy theories about the militias and, in the mainstream. And so there was this kind of, double paranoia happening at that time. So it was interesting that, the show sort of engaged them directly twice, but in very different ways. In Unrequited, they encounter a veteran who's sort of a Bogrites type. He leads a militia-style group called the Right Hand, and he initially seems like he's going to be the villain. But at the end, we find out that, what he's claiming about a POW MIA cover-up has turned out to be true. It's like the Vietnam, for those of you who are younger and don't remember there was the question of whether the U.S. government was covering up the fact that Vietnam was still holding American POWs. And in this one, the Pine Bluff variant, the militia is more clearly set out to be a villain. It's plugged into this fear, after the Oklahoma City bombing, with that, acts of terror were going to be conducted by militias. In this case, it was actually really interesting to rewatch this one right now in light of all the, bioweapon conspiracy theories we've been hearing during the coronavirus period. But even then, it gets more complicated. Not just because Mulder, you don't know to what extent he's bullshitting the guy and to what extent he's sincere, but he says he shares a lot of the militia's concerns. He just doesn't like their methods. But by the end, we find out that the feds have infiltrated the militia, that they're manipulating the militia, that there's it's basically laid out that they're hoping to have this sort of effort fail, but be used as an excuse to pass new laws, which kind of gets into some of the conspiracy theories you would hear about Oklahoma City within militia circles. And also, like, the means of spreading the bioweapon was going to be to spread it on cash, which, of course, turns, like, a central institution in American society into a tool of terror. So, basically, even when The X-Files does a story about dangerous subversives, by the end, it turns out to be a story about the secret government coming to get us, which is pretty interesting.
I thought maybe just because I was able to relate to it more, I thought this was like the most plausible to possibly happen. Maybe that's like, maybe that's a little bit of me like reading into conspiracy theories, just because there's no aliens, there's no people like talking to dead people or reading the future or Men in Black. So I guess like I was able to suspend disbelief just enough in this episode to be like, okay, like, this could like potentially happen. And there, Jesse hinted at, there's been conspiracy theories of late about how like the coronavirus was brought into society or released. And then I think it's been a fear probably for at least the last 10 to 15 years about one country having a bioweapon and just being able to absolutely demolish civilization. So I guess this show kind of just fed into that. But I think definitely of the five we watched, that this one was the most almost believable. And I still got to put almost in there.
It's interesting to me you say that, because the couple of times I've heard Alex Jones, for example, ranting about the X-Files, he uses it as evidence of the things that he believes in. And so, this example of the feds infiltrating and to a large extent orchestrating the actions of one of these militia groups, Mulder points out to the guy at the end, like, you killed all those people in the theater. That actually happened. And the guy in the bank, like, and you your credo is, well, the ends justify the means, and that's awful. And Alex Jones will use these examples as part of the argument that the X-Files is actually predictive programming, and that what Chris Carter is trying to do is tell us that, look, this is how it works, and you're going to gradually find out that all of this stuff is true. And he's in a way leading the edge here to change the culture so that people are willing to finally face up to these things, that the FBI does, you know, run most of the militias or hate groups and things like that in the country. And at a certain point, you can't really separate them. And, you know, I think it was Landry asked earlier, did this show convince anybody of aliens' existence? Well, it definitely convinced a lot of people that all of these things, the media, the government policy, the secret shadow government policy, they're all related and helping each other out. And that this is an example of media that tries to move us to the point where we accept these things, or we can't understand these things anymore. And we can't disentangle all of these threads. And so, you know, sometimes the militia people need to pay attention to storylines like this, because it's trying to show you how your group actually works, and you need to wake up, you know. So the hero for him in an episode like this is the militia guy who loses, right? Not the undercover Fed, but the militia guy who, you know, wants to take over the group.
I know this episode kind of feeds into a little bit of Cold War history coming up. And I know that Jesse had hinted at earlier that the X-Files attempts to almost rewrite Cold War history. Could you elaborate on that a little bit, Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, every time, or almost every time, they talk about, you know, the overarching mythology, it, you know, it goes back to the original sort of boom in UFO sightings after World War II at the beginning of the Cold War, which is a whole other topic we can get into.
Right.
but, you know, and it sort of reimagines the history, especially of like the 1950s. But also, I mean, this actually happens in that Forrest Gump episode, you know, things like the Kennedy assassination and all, through the lens of what all these people have been doing. And it's kind of this moment when, after the Cold War is done, it's possible for a lot of people. I mean, of course, during the Cold War, a lot of people were able to say, hey, I think our government is up to no good. But a lot of folks who were, you know, sort of loyal citizens, or whatever you want to call it, during the Cold War, were perhaps more willing afterwards to, at least in the bounds of fiction, to say, hey, let's question this. Let's see what insidious forces might have been at work. But by the way, this sort of relates to the Cold War and also to the bioweapons side of things. But earlier, I think it was Anthony who mentioned Paul Cantor. He has a line where he says, the central image of threat during the Cold War was a nuclear explosion, destruction that starts at a clear central point and spreads outward. The central image of threat in the X-Files is infection, a plague that may begin at any point on the globe and spread to any other. And that's something which I don't think went away when the War on Terror began. And that certainly still feels resonant right now. Just generally, there's this generalized dread about globalization and porous borders, and you know, what kind of invisible enemies might be even in the air, literally. And that's a big part of the X-Files. You can see that at work one of the fears in this episode, and obviously, it's still with us today.
And now for the time in our show that everyone looks forward to, where we explore the other types of media and content that we are enjoying during this time of social distancing. This is Locked In. So, Jesse, Anthony, what else are you enjoying during your time at home?
Well, apparently I must hate myself quite a bit, because I spent the weekend watching the entire Libertarian National Convention online. The world's first virtual convention by a major political party, nominating the first woman candidate for president in the party's history. It did end up with some pretty interesting results. But yeah, what an S show that was. I guess I'm a bit of a glutton for punishment, but it was very interesting to see how that virtual convention unfolded. And then I've been using, as I said earlier, I watched all of Twin Peaks, and that's just been fantastic. So I've been watching a ton of David Lynch interviews too. And I've been spending a lot of time on YouTube watching a fantastic series called Best of the Worst by Red Letter Media, where they have a panel that selects three awful B movies and they watch them and critique them. And it's just fantastic to see them turn really, really terrible movies that do practically everything wrong all in one big long string into complete gold.
So I just finished doing a binge watch over a few weeks of Person of Interest, which is one of those post X-Files shows. It's in this sort of space where it's too old to be contemporary, but not old enough to have like a hipster revival. So I might be the only person who was watching it. But I might write about it because it's really interesting politically, especially to revisit now. And it's also a case of someone of a show that does the mythology thing right. There's this, not only does it gets better as it goes along. I mean, the last three seasons are much better than the first two seasons, which are kind of, I'm half enjoying it, half, you know, mocking it. But also, I mean, every time they fill in the mythology a bit more, it never gets ridiculous. And it actually winds up turning into a master narrative that's really compelling. And the final season in particular, I liked a lot. I've also been, in my case, rewatching, in her case, watching for the first time with my teenage daughter, Cheers, which is fun.
Oh,
and
yeah.
My family has been, my other daughter is 8, so there's not a whole lot of stuff that's fun for both a 14-year-old and an 8-year-old. But we have had some family movie nights that have often been Pixar movies. And we watched all but one of, we didn't watch the Toy Story 4 because we had just seen it last year, but we watched the first three over the course of a week. And it's really interesting to watch those all together rather than spaced out as they came out in the theater, which is how I originally saw them. I mean, the first two I had not seen in more than two decades. I got to say, they hold up really well, better than I remembered. I mean, I liked them a lot the first time, and they were even, in some cases, even better than I thought they were the first time. So if you haven't seen them recently, go watch a Toy Story movie.
It's funny. So I have a 2-year-old nephew who is like obsessed with Toy Story. Like he only knows the names of like a few Disney characters at all. And he knows all the Toy Story characters. And he has like, we got him Toy Story bedroom and all that kind of stuff. So I actually did the same thing. I watched them all with him within like a week or so, not too long ago. And I thought it was very interesting because just the way it grows up, it's interesting to me because obviously I saw them when they came out and I love them then, but I love them for different reasons now, just because at Disney and Pixar do a really great job of kind of leaving in things for adults to get giggles out of as well. And I kind of enjoyed watching my nephew see it too and be so excited about Toy Story. Although his favorite Toy Story character is now Forky, just because it's in the most recent one. If you don't know who Forky is, you definitely need to see Toy Story 4. But that's also how my nephew learned the word trash, because Forky's always trying to throw himself away. So it's like little stories like that I really love about Toy Story or some of those older movies that kind of like grew up with me. Other things I've been watching. So when I was younger, we used to watch Survivor like pretty religiously as a family. We would like every week we'd like sit down and watch it at 8 p.m. That probably stopped when I was around like 12 and I kind of forgot the show existed. But now that I have Hulu, I like had been binge watching Survivor again. Just kind of something to have on in the background since I'm like working from home and I kind of like having noise on and I kind of like to see the drama. I also am into this weird show called Selling Sunset. It has Chrishell Hartley in it, which is, Justin Hartley's in the NBC show, This Is Us, that's her husband. But it's like a cross between like Love It or List It and like House Hunters and like Real Housewives. So it's a really interesting, so it's about like the Oppenheim group, which, works out of the Hollywood Hills and they sell real estate in Beverly Hills, Hollywood Hills and, like Bel Air and stuff. And it goes through like all of their office drama, but then it like for a solid like 20 minutes in the show too, they're like showing you these like crazy expensive, gorgeous houses in the Hollywood Hills. So it like has just enough drama to keep me hooked, but also like I also like the Fixer Upper, Love It or List It type shows. So it's an interesting cross between. It's on Netflix if you haven't seen it.
During my time at home, we are finishing and coming to the end of something I mentioned during our last recording, which is another excellent Bravo television show called Below Deck, about yachties that work on a mega
terrible.
Yacht.
It's awful.
Oh, it's so awful, but I do love it. So I'm kind of trying to find some new things, but I have recently been listening to the newest season of a podcast that has just started back up again called Articles of Interest, which is produced by Avery Truffleman, who is one of the producers for another very, very popular podcast called 99% Invisible, which is generally about design, hosted by Roman Mars. But one of their producers has this limited series project called Articles of Interest, as I mentioned before, that's mainly about clothing and tells these really incredible stories about how certain pieces of clothing came to be, became popular, accessories. So there's episodes about blue jeans. There's one about pockets. There's another about the one that I just listened to that was really, really fascinating that I had never thought about before. It was about perfume. And it became not just about perfume, but like the scent aroma industry and all of the different scents and products out there that have scents that you wouldn't think do, and how that industry and trends have changed from like the 50s and 60s into the 90s and today. And it was really interesting, but also very emotional because of all of the sort of sense memory and evocative nature that smell or sense of smell has that they discussed. So I learned a lot, but at the end, there's like some really emotional moments where they talk about appreciating your sense of smell and the memories that can and the emotions that those things can bring up. And it really got to me. I was walking back from the grocery store when I finished it, and I was tearing up a little, but it was in a good way. And I also have been listening to another few podcasts by another former 99% Invisible producer named Sam Greenspan. And they have produced one called Bellwether that I think there's only one episode out of. And they're currently trying to finish up the rest of the first season. And it's what they deem speculative journalism. So not like speculative fiction, but there is a sort of fiction frame narrative of someone in the future going through and cataloging and tagging this podcast that is a character sort of with an AI discussing this project that they're cataloging. And then you listen to the project itself, and it's this pieces of journalism that Sam Greenspan, the actual person making this, is conducting about usually technologies that are, you know, in development. So the first episode was about the driverless car that hit that woman in Arizona. And it's a really interesting discussion of artificial intelligence and the decision-making processes that they have to make for driverless cars and things that they call like the crumple zone and those split-second decisions that they have to make within this nested fictional narrative. And it's also just like really, really sonically interesting, amazing music and production that sounds at once very analog and organic, but still science fiction-y. So if you're into that, I highly, highly recommend it. I've also been trying to catch up on some old short story magazines that I had bought several years ago. They sadly stopped publishing the magazine, I think about a year ago, but Tin House publishes an amazing quarterly magazine of short fiction and poetry and reviews that I really, really enjoy. And I plan on watching Howl's Moving Castle very, very soon because my fiance really, really wants to watch it. And I think that'll be a nice escape. So I'm looking forward to some Miyazaki films to distract me from our current climate. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard,
have any tips leading to the solving of an X-File, or just want to let us know that you're one of our reptilian overlords who enjoys listening to the show, follow us on Twitter at PopAndLockPod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock with an E, Pod. Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is produced by me, Landry Ayers, as a project of libertarianism.org. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.